Welcome, curious people, to episode 5 of Where's Next, the podcast that brings you the origin stories from the countries we explore to help us better understand the world around us. I'm your host, Jack Thompson from Backpackers Blueprint, and today we're going to be taking on Panama. For me, Panama was quite a surprise, in a good way. It felt like it had a piece of everything in an extremely small area. The country is tropical with golden beaches. It's literally the epitome of paradise. Imagine screensavers on your computer. But it quickly changes into a tropical entity. And then after the tropics, you can usually find that gleaming city that is Panama City, with towering modern skyscrapers of steel and glass. And these are just a 5-minute ride away from Casco Fajardo, Panama's historic district, which has beautiful, colorful buildings that are the Spanish architecture and remind us of Panama's intrepid history. If you cross over to Panama from Costa Rica into David, then you find that really gritty urban fabrication and manufacturing center that fuels the city of Panama's economy. But if you take a half an hour drive from this area, then you'll find stunning hiking trails with views over the terrain that will take your breath away. It can be hot, really hot, but also humid. Panama has just 3 dry months a year, and the rest of the time you can be walking through blue skies 1 minute before black clouds roll over the top of you and the downpour begins. It feels like a world of opposites. But as we know, opposites can attract, and here in a world of polar opposites, it seems to work in an alluring and intriguing way. The beaches range from backpackers havens tucked away off beaten tracks to luxury trips for glamorous holidaymakers. The cities too have the same array. If you're on a shoestring budget, you seem to be able to find places you can eat and stay. But if you're a multimillionaire, you have a playground of luxury at your fingertips. The latest fashion, the fanciest cars, the skyscraper apartments with views of the ocean, the yacht trips to the Sandblast Islands. The paradoxes are unlike any you will see or experience up and down this Central American region. If you undertake the San Blas crossing by boat, then you can be eaten in a 5-star restaurant the day before jumping onto a tiny little speedboat before meeting the indigenous communities where coconuts are still currency. How bizarre is that? So, how has Panama got into this position? Well, today that's what we're going to find out in this episode of Where's Next. We're going to learn about the original indigenous communities and their fierce battle for survival against both, believe it or not, the Spanish and later their own Panamanian government. We'll talk about the invasion of the Spanish itself and how Panama became a center for trade and commerce. We will learn about the separation from the Spanish, but also the union of Panama with Colombia, Ecuador, and Venezuela, creating the short-lived Republic of Gran Colombia. We will talk about the canal, we have to really, don't we, before moving on to Panama today and some of the issues and its future outlook. By the end, we will hopefully understand a bit more about why this country is the way it is and what makes those opposites happen and why it's really worth visiting. So let's get into this and let's start, as we always start, with the earliest known point of human inception. The earliest history of Panama begins thousands of years ago with the arrival of the first indigenous people into the region. While specific dates are challenging to pinpoint, archaeological evidence suggests that humans have inhabited Panama for at least 12,000 years. Archaeological evidence suggests that during the Paleo-Indian period, nomadic hunter-gatherer groups migrated into the region, into present-day Panama, from the Northern Territories. These early inhabitants likely followed ancestry migratory routes across the Bering land bridge when North America was still joined to modern-day Russia. Traveling down south through North and Central America, people are likely to have landed in Panama and effectively settled. If you have listened to our previous podcast episodes, then you will know that people would go from being nomadic to being settlers. This would happen during the Archaic period, and this period is hard to put a total timestamp on, so I'm not going to. However, let's think of it more as a movement identifying the process of being nomadic into becoming more settled. We have alluded to agriculture being a massive part of allowing people to settle, and it does. However, the other thing that helps is water. Why? Simply because of the food source, fish. If we look at the indigenous cultures generally, we have the Kokul culture, the Choco, and we have the Chibchan-speaking people, who we learned about in our Nicaraguan podcast, who likely actually arrived from the south, not the north. The Kokul culture inhabited the region of the same name, just west of Panama City today. They're not well studied, but are largely identified through their pottery works, which itself has been phased into styled periods, much like, say, architecture is in the same manner. The Chibchan-speaking people inhabited various regions of Panama and neighbouring countries. Some of the Chibchan-speaking groups in Panama include the Ngabe, the Mbera, and the Guna people. These groups practiced agriculture, hunting, and fishing. Just as a quick side note here, the Kuna use a spoken language and there's no real alphabet, so the G or the K sound at the start is now written with a K. It used to be spelt G-U-N-A, but it's now spelt K-U-N-A. And it's kind of recently been established that the G and the K, the sound is effectively an amalgamation of the two letters, so it's effectively a Kuna sound. Something in the middle of the G and the K, or a combination, if you like. Anyway, let's get back to the history with the Choco culture. Now, these guys inhabited the region around the Darien Gap, or eastern Panama and western Colombia, if you like. They were skilled artisans known for their pottery and gold work as well, and the Choco people lived in small villages and practiced what's called slash and burn agriculture. This is literally how it sounds. Imagine taking a machete and cutting down an area, burning everything that has fallen to the ground, and what you get from the burn is a really rich nitrogen soil. So you effectively end up with quite fertile ground. Now, the Choco had villages that consisted of round dwellings on piles, and they usually had these alongside rivers. They used a bow and arrow for hunting, and they also had that kind of infamous blow dart image that we see in quite a few films. So that largely gives you an idea of the indigenous players in the Panama area. These would be living life as they would do through, you know, means of survival, hunting, fishing, gathering, and they did have their trade networks. And things weren't perfect, as we know, but effectively, things were relatively calm. Now, the Spanish would first arrive on the shores of Panama in 1501 with the explorer Rodrigo de Bastidas, leading one of the earliest expeditions to the region. We know that in 1502, Christopher Columbus explored the Caribbean coast of present-day Panama during his fourth and final voyage to the Americas. The most significant Spanish expedition to Panama was actually led by Vasco Nunez de Balboa in 1513. Now, Balboa crossed the isthmus and became the first European to sight the Pacific Ocean, and he claimed it and all the land it touches for Spain. I want to do another quick aside note here, because it's interesting, when you're in Panama, you'll find a brand of lager called Balboa. The logo is an image of Balboa himself, and it's kind of a weird little paradox to think about when sipping a beer in the San Blas Islands or generally in the provinces of the indigenous. Why? Well, let's go into that now. The Spanish colonization efforts intensified after their arrival, leading to the establishment of settlements and the exploitation of the indigenous peoples for labour and resources. The spread of European diseases such as smallpox and measles decimated indigenous populations, as we've seen in our previous podcasts, and with no immunity to these diseases, it led to significant population decline. Upon the arrival of the Spanish, many of the Guna communities retreated to the remote islands of the San Blas Archipelago. seeking refuge from this encroachment of the colonizers. The islands provided natural defences against Spanish incursions, allowing Laguna to become or to maintain their traditional way of life and resist assimilation into the Spanish colonial society. This allowed them to maintain their own religious beliefs and practices and keep their own identity and culture. And that would effectively remain the case until hundreds of years later, when the Panamanian government would effectively try to implement the same assimilation. So let's go back to the arrival of the Spanish and what happened as a consequence. The original settlement site of Panama City was founded in 1519 by Pedro Arias Davila. This was the first European city established on the Pacific coast of the Americas. It featured typical Spanish colonial architecture, including gridiron street layouts, central plazas, and the adobe or stone buildings that we've seen previously. Now, unlike in our last episode on Costa Rica, the fact of the matter here is that the materials like gold in Panama were abundant. And not just gold, there was silver, the lands were rich agriculturally, it had copper reserves, and it was a great spot for timber, dyes, resins, and even medical plants, which were all harvested from Panama's forests and used for trade and commerce. The Spanish settlers established plantations to grow these cash crops for export and domestic consumption, often relying on the indigenous labour to work the fields. Not only this, because of the long, slender nature of the Isthmus of Panama, it was the perfect spot to be used as a trade network. It had quick links to both the Atlantic and the Pacific. And thus, the Spanish spotted a further opportunity to try and monopolize the flow of goods, imposing tariffs, taxes, and other restrictions to maximize profits. It was the perfect economic and transport power hub. So, with this, we can guess what follows. The construction of road networks, churches to spread Catholicism, schools, but also because of this, the Spanish would also become under threat from other interested parties who could see the vast resources of Panama. Thus, fortresses such as Fort San Lorenzo were built to guard the entrance to key rivers and entry points. These forts can still be visited today and have become UNESCO World Heritage Sites, serving as reminders of Panama's rich history and heritage. But these forts were built for a reason, to fight off pirates. And pirate attacks came frequently, the greatest of which would eventually destroy the original site of Panama City. And this happened in 1671 by the Welsh privateer Henry Morgan. Morgan and his buccaneers captured Panama City after a series of bloody battles which the defending Spanish forces eventually just could not stop. The pirates looted the city, they stole pretty much everything, including gold, silver, and any other values they could find, before setting it on fire. The destruction caused by Morgan's raid was catastrophic, resulting in a near total destruction of Panama City, and the loss of countless lives. It was a huge setback for the Spanish, who would ultimately decide to move Panama City to a new location, where we can see Casco Viejo today. Casco Viejo, or the Old Quarter, is a well-preserved example of colonial architecture. It has churches, government buildings, and aristocratic mansions. When in Panama, there are walking tours dedicated to this area alone. It's an extremely pretty area full of charm and character, so if you do go to Panama City, make sure you visit it. There's some wonderful places you can just jump onto a rooftop bar, sip a glass of wine, and look over across at the city, well, the parallel opposite side of the city, effectively, the new side with all the gleaming skyscrapers from this really quintessentially cute Spanish architecture of the old town. Throughout the colonial period, Panama was an integral part of the Spanish Empire, governed as part of the Viceroyalty of New Granada, and this encompassed present-day Colombia, Venezuela, Ecuador, and, of course, Panama. By the late 18th century, the Spanish Empire was in decline, facing economic stagnation, political instability, and it was actually facing a lot of challenges from rival European powers. Spain's ability to maintain control over its colonies, including Panama, weakened as resources dwindled and colonial administrations became increasingly inefficient. By the early 19th centuries, discontent with Spanish rule was growing across the entirety of these Central American areas, fueled by the Enlightenment ideals, economic grievances, and the desire for political autonomy. Panama was influenced by movements in neighboring countries that we've heard about in our previous episodes, particularly though also from the south and the Gran Colombia. A federation led by Simón Bolívar that sought to liberate Spanish America from colonial rule. Bolívar's vision of a united Latin America resonated with many Panamanians who yearned for freedom and self-governance. On November 28th, 1821, a group of Panamanian leaders gathered in a town of La Villa de los Santos and declared Panama's independence from Spain. The declaration, known as the Acta del Grito de Independencia de la Villa de los Santos, proclaimed Panama's separation from Spanish rule and its desire to join the newly formed Republic of Colombia, led by Bolivia. This is why Panama is not really regarded as a Central American country, as unlike the other countries we have seen before it, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and of course Costa Rica, Panama's loyalty would be encompassed with the South. Yet although the alliance was set, it would not last long, and in 1831, Gran Colombia dissolved amid internal divisions and power struggles, leading to the emergence of a separate nation state, including the Republic of Colombia, present-day Colombia, and the Republic of Ecuador. Now, interestingly though, Panama's status within the new political order remained uncertain, as it became part of the Department of Istmo within the Republic of Colombia, yet Panama's quest for full independence continued into the 20th century. And this culminated in a separation from Colombia and a proclamation of the Independent Republic of Panama on November the 3rd, 1903. Panama's independence was actually facilitated by the support of the United States, which had vested interests in the construction of the Panama Canal and viewed an independent Panama as favourable to its geopolitical and economic objectives. So let's talk about the world famous canal. The construction of the Panama Canal began in 1904 under the supervision of the United States following Panama's independence from Colombia. In 1903, an agreement was put in place. This was called the Hay-Bunavarilla Treaty. Panama granted the US control over the Panama Canal Zone in perpetuity, sparking controversy and resentment in Panama. The Panama Canal Zone was effectively a 10-mile wide strip of land, and this extended the entire length of the canal. Critics accused the United States of engaging in imperialistic and colonialistic practices by imposing its will on weaker nations in pursuit of its own interests. That said, the United States government played a central role in planning, funding, and overseeing the construction of the Panama Canal. The project was spearheaded by the US Army Corps of Engineers, which was responsible for the design, engineering, and management of the construction efforts. An engineer by the name of John Frank Stevens was serving as chief engineer of the Panama Canal project from 1905 to 1907. He was responsible for implementing innovative engineering techniques and overcoming logistical challenges, including the management of the canal's water supply and the construction of the Gatun Dam. Stevens would effectively resign suddenly, and it would be George Washington Goethals who would succeed Stephen as chief engineer until the completion of the canal in 1914. There were workers from various countries, including the United States, the Caribbean, Europe and Asia, and they were all recruited to work on the canal. The working conditions were extremely challenging, with workers facing tropical diseases such as malaria and yellow fever, but there were also masses of health and safety fatalities as well. Frankly, the mortality rate among the workers was pretty significant. The first ship to officially transit the completed Panama Canal was the SS Ancon, a cargo and passenger steamship owned by the Panama Railroad Company. The SS Ancon made its historic passage through the canal on August 15th, 1914, marking the opening of the waterway to maritime traffic. It's estimated that the total cost of the building of the canal was approximately $375 million, which is extensive because we're going back over a century here. The figure includes expenses including engineering, excavation, labour and equipment, and all the infrastructure developments over the course of the construction period. Now, post the completion of the canal, there would be general unrest about the whole agreement. However, a new treaty would eventually be put in place to combat this. The Torrijos-Carta Treaty. This addressed the long-standing issues of sovereignty over the Panama Canal, which had been under US control since its construction in the early 20th century. The treaties aimed to transfer control of the canal and the canal zone from the United States to Panama, while also ensuring the continued operation and neutrality of the waterway. Interestingly, the US still have power today to intervene militarily to defend the Panama Canal against any threat to its security or operation. The treaty specified a timeline for a gradual transfer of responsibility, which culminated in a complete handover of the canal in December the 31st, 1999. Happy New Year, Happy New Millennia. So the canal has been operating under Panama's leadership effectively for, well, getting on quarter of a century now. I want to go back here to after the canal had been completed and back to the Guna tribe, who we mentioned right at the start of the episode, because shortly after the completion of the canal, the Guna would begin to come under attack from the Panamanian government, particularly between the 1920s and the 1930s. The government wanted the Guna to be part of mainstream society, including the implementation of Spanish and Christianity. The Guna people successfully resisted these attempts. In 1925, the Guna launched a rebellion against the Panamanian authorities known as the Tule Revolution in response to the government's attempts to exert control over their territories and ways of life. In 1938, the Guna would achieve a significant victory when they negotiated with the Panamanian government to establish a semi-autonomous indigenous territory of the Guna Yala, which granted them a degree of self-government and cultural autonomation. The Guna Yala remains one of the few autonomous indigenous territories in Panama, where the Guna people govern themselves according to their own customs, their own traditions, and their own legal systems. Today, the Guna continue to assert their cultural identity and preserve their traditional way of life with their autonomous territory, and this is why crossing these islands is a voyage unlike any you will ever take. So this lands us relatively close to the present. So what's going on today in Panama? Now, we know of the Torrijos-Carta Treaty. What I didn't tell you is that the man who would negotiate the treaty, Torrijos, would be a military leader who would stage a military coup and take the presidency of Panama in a bloodless takeover in 1968. Why? Well, as a response to widespread corruption and social inequality in Panama, and that embedded US overage hanging over the Panama people, he would quickly establish himself as the country's de facto ruler. On doing so, he implemented a series of social and economic reforms aimed at reducing poverty, improving access to education and healthcare, and addressing land distribution issues. He also pursued a policy of pragmatic nationalism, seeking to balance Panama's relationship with the United States whilst asserting the country's sovereignty and control over the Panama Canal. Now, Torrijos died in a plane crash on July the 31st, 1981, under circumstances that remain the subject of speculation and conspiracy theories. And whilst technically a dictator, he would also be seen as paving the way to social democracy. His premiership would be passed to his second-in-command, to a man named Manuel Noriega, or General Manuel Noriega. Noriega would be a very authoritarian-controlled ruler, and he faced massive international condemnation because he effectively had involvement in drug trafficking and human rights abuses that were kind of not really hidden. Now, Noriega's close ties with drug traffickers and his increasingly authoritarian rule strained relations with the United States. In 1988, he was indicted in the United States on charges of drug trafficking and money laundering, leading to the breakdown in diplomacy and relationships between Panama and the US. He was overthrown, effectively, and since then, and since the early 1990s, Panama has experienced a sustained period of political stability and democratic consolidation, with successive governments adhering to the democratic norms and principles. Peaceful transitions of power have become the norm in Panama, with regular elections and the peaceful transfer of authority from one administration to the next. Now, it's not all been perfect, so let's have a look at a few more recent events of history that are quite interesting to look at. In 2016, the Panama Papers were leaked by an anonymous source. The documents consisted of millions of files from the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca, which specialized in setting up offshore companies and trusts for clients seeking to avoid taxes and conceal assets. The Panama Papers sparked global outrage and led to investigations, resignations, and legal action in numerous countries around the world. The revelations exposed the extent of tax evasion, money laundering, and corruption facilitated by the use of offshore financial services, and this prompted calls for greater transparency, much more accountability, and greater regulation of the global financial systems. Even more recently, in just 2022, a cost of living crisis has effectively sparked mass protests by the younger generations who feel as though the country is heading towards a cliff edge that it can't come back from. In just 2023, further protests over a mining deal that allowed a minimum 20-year extension of contract with the Canadian-based First Quantum Minerals came under fire. The largest open copper mine near Colon is in the protected area of the Mesoamerican Biological Corridor. The protests would cause mass disruption, but also result in the approval of a law suspending new mining concessions in Panama by the National Assembly. And that kind of brings us up to date, so let's have a quick recap of everything we've learned today, and then you guys can get on your merry way. So today, we have found out that Panama is a beautiful isthmus which was first inhabited by the indigenous before the Spanish spotted the extensive mineral resources of the country and also realised due to its slender geography, Panama could be a very strategic position to control trade. The Guna, in particular, fled to the San Blas Islands and managed to maintain their autonomy and their way of life from the Spanish. The Spanish built fortification structures used to protect Panama City, and these have now become UNESCO World Heritage Sites. And we also find all of the Spanish architecture that we've become very familiar with in this first season of Where's Next. The resources and position of Panama attracted numerous pirate attacks, with Henry Morgan being one of the final ones to overthrow the Spanish in Panama City. He looted it, and then he burnt it to the ground, meaning a new Panama City would be built, which we can find at Casco Viejo today. The Spanish would dwindle in power before Panama would gain a slice of independence, although it would become part of Gran Colombia, an alliance with Colombia, Venezuela, Ecuador, and of course itself, Panama. This would be short-lived, and Panama would become a country in 1903 with support from the US, who had invested interests in the country and particularly the construction of the canal. The canal was completed but caused a bit of tension up and down the country due to the power the US had over its workings and general area. Shortly after the completion of the Panama Canal, the Panamanian government would attempt to assimilate the Guna, who would resist and eventually be recognized as part of Panama, but retaining its own autonomy and traditions. Today, the Guna are celebrated as a very important part of Panama's history. Finally, a general by the name of Omar Torrijos would stage a coup in 1968 in an attempt to rebalance the books for Panama over the US's substantial prominence. This would result in the Torrijos-Carter Treaty, which phased back control to the Panama people, and this was completed in 1999. Today, Panama is a relatively stable country, however, it has recently seen some uprising and protests due to cost of living, possible corruption, and some unfavorable policies. And there we have it, your overview on the background of Panama to help you understand a bit more about the country. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I'm trying to refine them all the time and get them to where I think they need to be to give you as much information as possible, as quickly as possible, but not too much and diluted information. Anyway, next time we're going to go back north to Honduras, a country teeming with more of the Mesoamerican culture, some of which has only been discovered in recent times. If you want to discover these secrets, then tune in next time to Where's Next. And don't forget to check out the website where you can learn a lot more about architecture and travel. And please like and share and tell your friends about us if you found any of this information here today useful or fruitful for your own adventures. It would be much appreciated. Until the next one, take care, explorers, and speak to you very soon.